successfully. Meanwhile, the Taliban has rejected that and has said that it will not form a government until all foreign and U.S. forces leave Afghanistan. Is the Taliban ready to form a government, and what will it do about the resistance stronghold of Panjshir? Just some of the questions we'll be asking in this edition of The Spotlight. But first, to get an update, Amin Alami is a correspondent joining us from Afghanistan's capital, Kabul. Lots to cover in a short period of time. Give us the latest that you can, Amin.
Well, Kaba, despite American sources here in Kabul say that the situation is under their control in Kabul International Airport, but Taliban authorities say that the American troops have failed to bring the situation under their control in order to prevent the ongoing chaos in the Kabul International Airport. For instance, we can say that at least seven individuals, including an Afghan soldier, were killed as a result of chaos and gunfire inside the Kabul International Airport. In the meantime, there are hundreds of Taliban members who are guarding the entrance gates of Kabul International Airport, preventing the people from entering this area, as well as there are also thousands of foreign troops, mainly American forces, UK troops, French soldiers, and as well as other foreign national military forces who are working to evacuate their own nationals, as well as Afghan nationals who have worked with them. In the meantime, the Taliban are also very busy, not only with the chaos and the in Kabul International Airport and the rest of issues here in the Afghan capital, Kabul, mainly when it comes to governance issues, but they are currently, they have currently surrounded Panjshir Valley or Panjshir Province and north east of Kabul. Ahmed Massoud, who is the son of the Afghan legendary commander Ahmed Shah Massoud, is there, and he says that I will resist against the Taliban if they refuse to accept the establishment of an inclusive government that must address the need of the people of Afghanistan and that must respect many other issues such as human rights and democratic values. In the meantime, political consultations and meetings are also underway here in the Afghan capital, Kabul, between Taliban leadership and some prominent political leaders, including some former Afghan government officials. For instance, Abdullah, who was the head of Afghan Reconciliation Council, recently met with a high number of Taliban leaders. Hamid Karzai is another key figure who was the former Afghan president. He has also met with top political leaders, as well as Hikmatyar has done so. These moves show that the Taliban are strongly after gaining control, politically gaining control over Afghanistan via gaining legitimacy, first inside Afghanistan, right, and second, they are after gaining regional and international legitimacy. That is why we see that there are some reactions by regional powers and international countries, for instance, Iran, Russia, France, and UK. All of them has had their own viewpoint or stance regarding to the ongoing situation in Afghanistan. For instance, Russia says that Moscow is not concerned or worried about the ongoing situation in Afghanistan, particularly the rule of Taliban over Kabul, because as the Russian foreign minister recently said, the Taliban has proved to be committed to most of their commitments. So this shows that the situation is going to be more complex in Afghanistan. That is why top politicians inside Afghanistan are also calling on the Taliban and the rest of players inside this country to urgently find a solution to put an end to the ongoing situation and a situation that is called vacuum of power in Afghanistan, in order to see a stable Afghanistan. But in the meantime, People are worried, not only here in Kabul, but across Afghanistan. Millions of people have so far been displaced, and hundreds of thousands of them have so far been left the country. The leaving of Afghanistan by its residents are continuing. That is why the Taliban are also trying to prevent the people from leaving Afghanistan behind, because they say that we are here to bring peace, security, and create jobs for Afghans. But as you see, and as we saw on the streets of Kabul here, there are less presence of women here, and it proves that the Taliban needs to work further to prove that they are committed, to, especially when it comes to their promises.
Thank you very much for that, Amin Alami. We do appreciate it. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight, Professor of History at James Madison University, Shah Mahmood Hanifi, who joins us from Washington, D.C. An author and academic and an expert on Afghanistan, Muhammad Daoud Meraki, who joins us from Chicago.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you both, and let me start with you, Shah Mahmood Hanifi, if I may, from Washington, D.C. I don't want to reiterate or repeat something that's been going on in the past days, and that is this messy evacuation that's taking place at Kabul International Airport. When you take a look at what's really going down here, when the U.S. has to have the Pentagon come out and brief reporters and the world daily, every day, as to what's going on there, tell us what that really reflects and what that really shows, because some are saying that shows how unorganized Afghanistan was in terms of the way that it was executed based on the occupation that took place, and others are saying that this is a negative reflection on America's waning power. How do you see it?
Well, I think both of those viewpoints carry some legitimacy. The president's need to speak to the American public reflects, I think, a number of interest groups in the American political space, particularly veterans who are quite prominent and animated about maintaining, I guess, some ethic of comradeship in war, or something that necessitates ultimately or justifies the situation in Kabul at the airport. And that situation, to me, is the result of something that must have had some management to it. And I'm not sure about the particular players, but Damne Khalilzad would seem to have a role in the bloodless, really very few shots fired in Kabul or elsewhere when the Taliban gained control of the capital. It's quite how that happened is, I think, not accidental, but that the result of the Taliban and Ghani's flight result in this situation at the airport that I think involves both very public American statements by the president and very clear, visible actions at the airport, but the American empire has been working at a public level, such as we just addressed, while at the same time working at a covert level that we just do not know precisely what communications with the Taliban and other actors, what extractive techniques by helicopter from the Baron Hotel, for example, recently, is going on.
Uh-huh.
So I think, as always, with the American political arena, there is so much that the American public is not aware of and that the government won't speak to because of securitization and sequestration of information.
Sure. Well, when you want to take a look at the response over here, Muhammad Dawood Meraki, the Taliban has said that they're not going to abide or listen to the Americans to have an extension beyond that August 31st deadline, in which the U.S. president at this point is contemplating it. Do you think that the Taliban, and they've actually warned the U.S. on this, do you think the Taliban is going to follow up on the threats of the U.S. delayed departure, if you want to call it, from the country?
It's a complicated situation that we have at hand here. You see, we need to look back at what the United States had done post the Doha agreement. And they had agreement that they will not violate such and such and such, whatever they agreed upon. But toward the end, before the victory in Kabul, the United States military has violated that agreement more than 800 times. The Taliban a few times, and it's been observed by others as well. Taliban trying to use, rational thinking for the most part here. They realize that Americans have departed and they have no way of remaining in the country, and they got defeated, whether somebody accepted or not. But they don't want to complicate the situation. They don't want to exacerbate the already complicated situation and add to the animosity and to the onset of conflict. Their aim is political. Their aim is trying to form a government and get a recognition and have services to the people, to the population, and put an end to this disorder that's been going on in the airport. Must also add that this disorder was created by the United States government as a brain drain, if you like. There's been a lot of technical people that have been moving out from here, and they have been reluctant to prevent people from entering the airport. They simply mentioned that everybody is welcome as long as they're able to come. And so now people are concerned about leaving the country. Remember, there was barely any option for them to leave the country. Now they have a free ticket, so to speak, and a lot of technical people are leaving and they're leaving the country. So they created this mess, and the Taliban are waiting, hoping they will put an end to it, and they will fulfill their obligation and leave the country by the 31st of August. Okay. But whether the Taliban will react, it's more a political issue at this point than a military one.
Well, when you take a look at the statements coming from the Taliban, as you said, it sounds like they're coherent, organized. Their approach is such that violence has decreased. But at the same time, there are question marks about whether they're actually going to be able to form a government. You have, on the one hand, if you want to call it a new administration called the Taliban that has to run the economy, but they have their funds frozen by the U.S. Overseas. At the same time, you have this resistance stronghold, Panjshir Valley, that they have to deal with. So they still have to, defuse that and put that fire out. Do you think they'll be able to do all of this and still be able to govern the country?
You see, first of all, this Panjshir business has been really blown out of proportion. It was a mistake of Taliban to resort to suggestion by others, by elders, to let's not increase this unity and let's symbolically do not attack Panjshir and so forth. He took over all of Afghanistan in a blink of an eye. And then their mistake was they should have, once they took over Badakhshan and Tahar, they should have straight came into Panjshir and cleaned it up. But now the West, they need stooges. You see, the Henry Levy, the Zionist philosopher, he has advocated or popped up this individual, Ahmed Massoud, in Paris and introduced him to the president of France. Like his father, he is also serving foreign interests. There's nothing legendary about him, about his father. His father was a prophet of the Russians.
Let me jump in here to make sure that we understand you correctly. You're saying that Israel is responsible for some kind of support that he is giving this person from what's called the National Resistance Front, Ahmed Massoud. Did I understand you correctly here?
This Zionist by Henry Levy, his name is, he's from France. He has been involved in most Muslim countries in the conflict and instigates so-called resistance in order to create disorder in Muslim society. He has done the same thing back in the 90s. He came to Panjshir doing the same thing, and he's done the same thing this time.
Okay.
The issue is this. The Taliban wanted to avoid bloodshed.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to hold on to your thoughts. Let me bring Shah Mahmoud Hanifi back into the conversation here. So let's look at the international either acceptance or rejection or a state of doubt at this point when it comes to the Taliban. For example, the European Union, it has not recognized the Taliban. The EU Commission President saying that, it's not holding political talks with what it calls the militants, and this a week after they seized control of Afghanistan. How do you see the international recognition coming when it comes to the Taliban? Is the Taliban looking for it, or is the Taliban going to be happy with its immediate either acceptance or getting along of with its neighbors? We can mention Russia, we can mention obviously China, and also Iran that has asked for a reconciliation to involve all groups within the country in order to, establish peace and security?
Well, again, some of the public recognition by China and by Russia are one thing, but behind the scenes diplomatic maneuvering, Pakistan has not been mentioned. Pakistan's strategic depth has been apparently furthered with the Taliban returning to power. And I think the point about American withdrawal is a bit of overstatement. I don't think the United States will be removing its presence in Afghanistan. Its covert presence, and it does involve intelligence agencies. And in this sense, the international community now has a number of constellations of groups, the European Union for one. But as our previous speaker so helpfully noted, within the European Union, certain countries, in this case France, exert, leverage upon the whole in ways that make potentially France's bilateral perspective on the Taliban broader to include the European Union's, policy position.
Let me bring in the guest then and see if he agrees with you on this, because you mentioned that the U.S. is not going to actually really withdraw, but covertly it's going to have a presence. Do you agree with that, Mr. Meraki? Is the U.S., even though it has said it's withdrawn itself, but it's going to have some kind of a presence, which then I ask you, does that mean that indirectly, it's going to somehow have some kind of contact with the Taliban?
The contact Taliban will have contact with everyone in the world, all the governments. And the U.S., of course, has been asking Pakistan, has been asking Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, as well as Kyrgyzstan and other countries for military base. They are worried, supposedly, this boogeyman they call Al-Qaeda is going to evolve again out of nowhere with supposedly 150-something people in 2001, and then it's been obviously hatching exponentially. It's not disappearing, and so their perspective is that they want to be vigilant in the region. And the fact of the matter is the United States all along was concerned to be present in Afghanistan in order to monitor monitor activity in China and Russia, and also to contain whatever they choose to contain, and also instigate domestic disorders in those societies. Whatever contentions were there, they wanted to manipulate it for their own end.
Okay, I'm going to ask that question. I'm sorry, because we're fresh out of time. In 30 seconds, if you can, Shah Mahmoud Hanifi, will the U.S. continue its cooperation one way or another with the Taliban, perhaps for its own means, such as countering China and maybe even with an eye on Iran?
I believe, again, in some form, yes, the United States will continue to engage who's ever in power in Kabul. And I think the support that the United States may extend to not just Ahmad Shah Massoud, but Saleh, who is there now as well, will remain a conduit of influence in the political equation of Afghanistan.
Unfortunately, I got to jump in. We're just fresh out of time on this. Thank you so much. Let me thank our guest, Professor of History, James Madison University, Shah Mahmoud Hanifi. Thank you. And academic author and expert on Afghanistan, Muhammad Dawood Meraki. And, of course, Manami Nalami at the top of the debate. I'm sorry, at the top of the spotlight. From Mikoa Tawai, the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
The thought on my mind that how grateful we are to have you, oh Hussein.
Insight into the Holy Quran.
And I thank you, Allah. I thank you, Allah. I thank you, Allah. I thank you, Allah.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we are trying to talk about the different verses of the Holy Quran, which are thematically connected to our topic, which is Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. So stay with us, and let's listen to some of the verses.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. And abide in your houses, and do not display yourselves as was the display of the former times of ignorance. And establish prayer, and give zakah, and obey Allah and His Messenger. Allah intends only to remove from you the impurity of sin, O people of the Prophet's household, and to purify you with extensive purification.
Dear listeners, Imam Hussein alayhi salam says, Inna ahlu baytin nas'alullah fayu'tina. We, the Ahlul Bayt, beseech Allah and He grants us.
And then Imam Hussein continues, and if He wills to do that which we abhor, provided that it will bring about His pleasure, we submit. Brothers and sisters, Ahlul Bayt's submission to Allah is a state that they are not compelled to reach. It is a truth that they have attained with their
personal efforts, and they have attained this at its climax, their station of submission to Almighty Allah. It is said to be the last of several stations that a spiritualist follower can get through. And since this level belongs to the Holy Prophet and the Holy Imams and the Saints, only few spiritualists have ever reached this station. So that's why Imam Hussein alayhi salam says, "We submit to that which the Almighty Allah wills, which is against what we like, but yet we submit." Let's have a look at another instance of this submission. Ala bin Kamil says, "I was sitting in the presence of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam when a woman from the house of the Imam started wailing. The Imam rose up and then sat down, saying, 'Surely we belong to Allah, and unto Him we return. Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un.' He kept on repeating so till he said, 'Inna lanuhibbu an nu'afa fi anfusina wa awladina wa amwalina.' We favor safety as regards life, property, and our children. فَإِذَا وَقَعَ الْقَضَاءُ فَلَيْسَ لَنَا أَن نُحِبَّ مَا لَمْ نُحِبَّ اللَّهُ لَنَا. But when there is divine decree, we do not love what Allah does not love for us." And this is exactly what renders all the burdens of calamity of Karbala easy for Imam Hussein to carry, because they have total submission.
He who loves you admonishes you from wrongdoing, and he who hates you entices you into wrongdoing.
In this connection, Imam Baqir alayhi salam says, "Nad'u Allah fima nuhib, fa'idha waqa'a alladhi nakrahu lam nukhalif Allah azza wa jal fima ahab." We call on Allah for what we love to be given to us, but if something happens that we do not love, we will not oppose it. We have many instances of these cases throughout our traditions. One of the companions of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, "I once went to visit his child, but I found the Imam sitting at the threshold. I said, 'May I be sacrificed for you? How is your child?' Then Imam alayhi salam said, 'By Allah, he does not feel well.' Then he went inside the house. He was delayed for an hour and then came out with no sign of sorrow in his face. I thought that his child was better at the moment, so I asked, 'How is the child?' The Imam answered, 'He passed away.' I said, 'May I be sacrificed for you? How is it that when he was alive you were sad, but now that he has passed away, you are no longer sad?' The Imam said, 'Inna Ahlul Bayt najza'u qabla al-musibah.' We Ahlul Bayt wait before calamity comes. فَإِذَا وَقَعَ عَمْرُ اللَّهِ رَضِينَا بِقَضَائِهِ وَسَلَّمْنَا لِأَمْرِهِ. But when the divine decree comes, we are pleased with it and we submit to his decree." Brothers and sisters, this is completely related to the fact that the Ahlul Bayt are the true embodiments of the attributes of the Almighty Allah. They are well aware that whatever is going to happen to them is by Almighty Allah's will, and although they try to do their responsibilities best and they try to reach the result, but they never worry about the results, because they are pleased with it, because they totally submit to his decree. Brothers and sisters, we will inshallah talk about another aspect of the existence of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam in the next program. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
دمعت عليك ظلت تنزل جروح يا ابو اليمة بمصابك ذابت الروح طلب راية توفقني بخدمتك ولا تحرمني من الدمع والنور يا ابو النعمة وباب للرحمة أدري توفيقي هو أسبابه إلك أسأل وانت تتفضل من توظفني خادم ببابك يا سيدي نسألك الدعاء يا سيدي نسألك الدعاء يا وجيها سيدي نسألك الدعاء يا سيدي اشفع لنا
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight. Britain plans to establish offshore asylum centres for Afghan refugees in countries such as Pakistan and Turkey, as ministers admit that the United Kingdom will not be able to rescue those eligible for resettlement before troops leave Kabul, the Afghan capital. The Defence Secretary Ben Wallace said in a newspaper article on Sunday, 22nd of August, that the United Kingdom planned to establish a series of processing hubs across the region outside of Afghanistan for Afghans it had an obligation to. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Observer journalist Dan Sabag. The piece is titled UK Plans Offshore Asylum Centres in Other Countries for Afghans. Britain plans to establish offshore asylum centres for Afghan refugees in countries such as Pakistan and Turkey, as ministers admit that the United Kingdom will not be able to rescue those eligible for resettlement before troops leave Kabul. Britain's Defence Secretary Ben Wallace said in a newspaper article on Sunday, 22nd of August, that the United Kingdom planned to establish a series of processing hubs across the region outside of Afghanistan for Afghans it had, quote, an obligation to, unquote. At least 1,429 Afghans have been evacuated from Kabul since last Friday as part of the Arab relocation scheme designed to help interpreters and others who have helped the British troops during their 20 years of occupation in Afghanistan. But it is estimated that a similar number or more remain in the country. The emergency airlift was continuing on Sunday with RAF flights operating despite a crush at the airport gates as desperate Afghans tried to flee Afghanistan. NATO believes 20 people have died around the airport in the last week, but Britain's Armed Forces Minister, James Hippie, said the flow outside the airport had improved because the Taliban were marshalling people into separate queues for the US evacuation and the UK evacuation. A total of 1,721 people, Britons, Afghans and people from allied countries, had been evacuated from Kabul on 8 flights in the past 24 hours. James Hippie said, with the RAF receiving help from its Australian counterpart in getting people to safety. But British officials already acknowledge it is virtually impossible to evacuate people coming from outside of Kabul, Afghanistan's capital, although Afghans with a claim have told charity workers they would risk crossing the country if they knew they had a flight. The new proposal was born out of the emergency, Britain's Defence Secretary Ben Wallace said in an article in the Mail on Sunday. The Arab scheme is not time-limited. We shall stand by our obligations and are investigating now how to process people from third countries and refugee camps, he wrote. However, there were signs that the asylum plan had not been very far developed on Sunday night, 22nd of August, when Turkey said it had not been approached and would reject any approach that was made. A scheme to establish an offshore immigration centre was included as part of the Home Office's Nationality and Borders Bill, published in the early summer before the Western-backed government in Afghanistan collapsed. It was controversial because the intention was to allow the United Kingdom to send people to a third country to allow their claims to be processed over there. Officials had begun talks with Denmark about creating a processing centre in Africa, but how it will link together to the emergency centres is unclear. Britain has also agreed to take 20,000 Afghan refugees in a separate scheme announced on Tuesday, 5,000 of which will be in the first year. Priority will be given to groups who are most at risk of human rights abuses, such as women, girls, and those from religious minorities. Ministers are also debating how to respond to the Taliban, with the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, understood to be exploring with security officials whether they should be proscribed as a terrorist organization. However, Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson and other government departments have been holding out the possibility of recognising the Taliban government in Kabul, arguing that the Taliban should be judged by their actions and not words.
68 years ago, the first democratically elected government in the Middle East and West Asia was overthrown in an Anglo-American coup plot. The victim was Mohammad Mossadegh, the champion of the nationalization of the oil industry in Iran. Operation Ajax, as the plot was codenamed by the Americans, and Operation Boot, as it is referred to by the British, reshaped the history of Iran, the Middle East, and even the world. It restored Mohammad Reza Shah to the peacock throne, a luxury with an iron fist that eventually sparked the Islamic Revolution of 1979 in Iran. On March 15, 1951, legislation to nationalize the Iranian industry was passed by the Majlis. Spearheaded by Dr. Mossadegh, the courageous move won him huge popularity among the masses, but at the same time earned him British enmity. Britain, which did not want to lose its privileges regarding the Iranian oil fields, built up diplomatic pressure, asked the UN to intervene, and in the end, tried to threaten the Iranian government by sending the British Navy to the Persian Gulf against Mossadegh, who assumed power in the Prime Minister's office a month later. Despite all this, Mossadegh emerged triumphant from the 1952 parliamentary elections and used the victory to intensify anti-Shah and anti-British rhetoric. Iranian oil was an existential priority for the United Kingdom. The Iranian refinery of the Anglo-Iran Oil Company, AIOC, which would later become British Petroleum, BP, was the world's largest refinery. Depending largely on Iranian resources, the company was the world's second largest crude oil exporter with the third largest reserves under its control. Perhaps an even more important fact, the company alone met the British Navy's 85% fuel needs. Unable to take the Iranian Prime Minister under control, Britain sought America's blessing to act against Mossadegh's government. But President Harry Truman explicitly rejected such British proposals. The elections in the United States, however, came to Britain's aid. Shortly after Dwight Eisenhower's election in November 1952, Britain sent agents to Washington and persuaded the new president's team to orchestrate the coup. For this purpose, Kermit Roosevelt, the Middle East director of the CIA, arrived in Tehran in June 1953 and began bribing a significant number of politicians and journalists to destroy Mossadegh's popularity and create chaos in Iran as a precursor of the coup. The demonization of Mossadegh began through fabrications and slanders, a systematic effort to influence public opinion against the politician who stood outside the orbit of the West.
The US and Britain had the same level of involvement in carrying out the coup. As much as $5 million were spent buying support from senior officials, military officers, newspaper editors and thugs to carry out the Western-backed plot to overthrow the democratically elected Prime Minister Mossadegh.
At the same time, Britain launched an economic war against Iran along with an international propaganda campaign. London also froze Iran's assets in Britain, forbade exports of oil drilling equipment to Iran. The British also started threatening potential customers interested in Iranian oil. The US, on the other hand, cancelled a previously promised $25 million loan to Iran. The circle around Mossadegh began to narrow as the markets and ordinary traders began to feel the pinch of the economic crisis. It was then that Churchill and Eisenhower officially ratified the coup plan in early July. They made the Shah issue an order for the dismissal of Mossadegh from his post, even though it was against the constitution. After a failed coup attempt on August 15th, which led to the escape of Mohammad Reza Shah abroad, the second attempt on August 19th caught the Iranian Prime Minister off guard. The crowd on the CIA's payroll seized the streets, while pro-Shah forces besieged Mossadegh's residence and captured him after 9 hours of fighting. Mossadegh was tried in a military court, served 3 years in prison, and died under house arrest in 1967.
As a result of this coup, Mohammad Mossadegh was arrested, tried, and convicted of treason by the Shah's military court. This is the tip of the iceberg that shows and reveals the expansionist policies of the hegemonic powers in the world.
The monarchy, restored under the pro-Western Shah and Anglo-Iranian oil renamed British Petroleum, tried to get its fields back, though it could return to the conditions prior to the nationalization of oil. The effects of the coup were far more profound than those planned by the coup plotters. Kinza, in his book All the Shah's Men, writes, a significant factor behind the public anger toward the US during the Islamic Revolution was the role played by Washington in the 1953 coup. The coup, an imperialistic response to the nationalization of oil, is still regarded as the root cause of distrust between Iran and the US. After almost seven decades after the coup, the Iranian nation is still cynical about the Americans' intentions at the highest levels. In the words of former CIA operator Robert Baer, Iranians truly believe that if it weren't for the CIA, the Shah would never have been brought to power, and they believe that the CIA continues to operate as an evil force in their country. American and British involvement in Mossadegh's ouster was long public knowledge, but neither the Americans nor the British formally acknowledged their roles until 64 years later. On August 19, 2013, the CIA publicly admitted for the first time its involvement in the 1953 coup. Denied by Britain until 2020, the coup exposes the machinations of the Western powers to dispose popular civilian politicians while backing repressive rulers like the Shah of Iran whenever their interests require it. Last year, a discovered transcript of an interview with a British intelligence officer indicated that Britain was the driving force behind the overthrow of Mossadegh. In his account, Norman Derbyshire said Britain had convinced the US to take part in the coup. A part of the transcript reads, "The plan would have involved seizure of key points in the city by what units we thought were loyal to the Shah, seizure of the radio station, etc., the classical plan." The 1953 coup dashed all the hopes of a nation that yearned for a democratic government during the tyranny of Mohammad Reza Shah and poisoned the relationship between Iran and the US in the following decades. Iran's deep distrust of the US is firmly founded on what the Americans did on August 19, 1953.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. Please accept our condolences on the arrival of the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Panahian. Please stay tuned.
بفهمیم که خدا عشق برای ابا عبدالله الحسین، اظهار ارادت به امام حسین و زیارت ابا عبدالله الحسین رو رد نمی‌کنه.
We must understand that Allah does not reject the tears which are shed for Abu Abdullah al-Husayn. Allah does not reject expression of love for Imam al-Husayn or the ziyarah of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn. You remain, and Imam al-Husayn remains. The one who cries out on the day of Qiyamah will ask, "Where are the visitors of Husayn?" A group of people will rise up. Allah will ask them, "What did you wish by performing the ziyarah to the tomb of Imam al-Husayn? what was your niyyah or intention? They will say, O Lord, we went for the love of the Messenger of Allah and the love of Imam Ali and Hazrat Fatima, and because our hearts were burning in grief for Imam al-Husayn.
Karbala, as I step onto your sand, you capture my eyes. Karbala, I see heaven has been placed here beneath your sky.
خدا چجوری برخورد میکنه؟ فیقال لهم.
Now, how will Allah respond to this saying? He will say to them, you did so for this reason? Here are Muhammad, Ali and Fatima, Hassan and Hussein. Go and join them. You are with them among their ranks. Go under the flag of Prophet Muhammad. They will go under the Prophet's flag and hold it and surround him and enter the paradise along with him. Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam is an opportunity.
باید ما یک کمی قیامت رو بدونیم، یعنی چی، تا این اتفاقی که اونجا میفته رو معنا کنیم برای خودمون. امام حسین علیه السلام یک فرصت فوق‌العاده است.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Panahian. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care, and Assalamu alaik, Ya Aba Abdullah al-Husayn.
Beginning, the season's tears are flowing. Our Imam, we are condoling. Our new year starts with morning. Muharram is a beginning. The season's tears are flowing. Our Imam, we are condoling. Karbala, what precious blood was spilled there? Ashura, Al Hussein was murdered here. Ashura.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, an ambitious $11 billion project that would transport natural gas from Russia directly to Germany by bypassing Ukraine. The project will double the existing Nord Stream pipeline running from Russia to Europe across the Baltic Sea and is a sustainable way to ensure European energy security. The Nord Stream 2 project is close to completion, yet it has for long caused tensions between Moscow and Washington. The United States sees the project as a potential threat, believing that it will increase Europe's dependence on Russian gas exports and isolate Ukraine. As a matter of fact, by bypassing Ukraine, Russia and the European Union could save the transit fees that make up to 3% of Ukraine's GDP. In addition, Washington worries that Moscow's success in transferring natural gas to Europe would undermine the effectiveness of U.S. sanctions in place against the country since 2014 due to the conflict in Ukraine. On Friday, Washington slapped new sanctions on a ship and two entities involved in the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project. At the same time, U.S. President Joe Biden issued an executive order allowing for sanctions to be imposed on certain Russian officials. Although this deepens the rift between the U.S. and Russia, it is unlikely to have much impact on the nearly completed energy project. The U.S. and Germany had struck an agreement when it came to Nord Stream 2. The Biden administration waived sanctions on the company overseeing the construction of the pipeline and its chief operating officer, yet it goes ahead with sanctioning the Russian officials. It appears that the U.S. is still after sabotaging this project.
But basically, they're trying to look tough, even though they're kind of surrendering, because it's clear that the Nord Stream will take place. Who is very much kind of stand to lose as a result of that is Ukraine, because, you know, Ukraine utilizing the whole pipeline, more or less 20% of their income depends on that. So Ukraine is going to lose money, and that's what the United States' interest is. They ask Germany to help. They don't want to pay themselves, so they push Germany to help Ukraine. But so that's the bottom line. But, you know, so they can sanction the Russians, but they more or less will have to agree with the Nord Stream to go on.
Britain and the U.S. both targeted seven Russians with sanctions and also issued a joint statement warning Russia over chemical weapons. The targeted Russian individuals are described as Russian security officials allegedly involved in a nerve attack on Navalny last year. This is while Moscow has denied any involvement in the incident. Washington separately imposed sanctions on another two men and four Russian institutes it said were involved in chemical weapons research or what it described as an assassination attempt against Navalny. Navalny was poisoned using a nerve agent. He was flown to Germany for medical treatment after falling ill in Siberia on August 20th last year. Though he survived, he was arrested in January when he returned to Russia. The U.S. has been on the forefront with anti-Russia rhetoric over Navalny's case, including his alleged poisoning. This is while Kremlin has said it will not allow any foreign interference in its domestic affairs. In response to the latest round of sanctions over Nord Stream 2 and the Navalny case, Russian Foreign Ministry condemned the measures as unilateral and illegitimate, vowing that Moscow's response to sanctions will be tough and appropriate.
The developments in Afghanistan have been making headlines for the past few days following the chaos that ensued the abrupt U.S. troops withdrawal from the country. The Taliban's meteoric rise to power and pandemonium at the Kabul airport prompted criticisms against how the U.S. pulled out its troops and also the outcome of the 20-year war on Afghanistan. Western politicians were among those expressing regret over incidents in Afghanistan, with German Chancellor Angela Merkel saying it appeared that all the troops killed in the war had died in vain. But that's not the only bitter legacy of the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan. Russia's Security Council Secretary Nikolai Petrushev has said that Washington turned the Central Asian country into a global illicit drug laboratory in the past 20 years. In an interview, the Russian security chief noted that the production of opiates in Afghanistan have increased over 40-fold during the past two decades.
Well, obviously, a lot of this was being produced during the time that the United States and the NATO forces were active in Afghanistan, and there was really never a concerted effort.